Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
That's why we have to think as black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking. Wow. Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV. And not getting addicted to looking at those small iPhone screens. See, where you were getting accustomed to looking there in a narrow space as opposed to paying attention broadly to what is happening around you. See, and people are getting addicted. That's why some people got tragically are getting hit by automobiles, because they won't even stop looking long enough to look and see which way the traffic is flowing.
Autumn Karen writes for a living, but rarely gets to see her name in print. Autumn is a ghostwriter, and most of the projects she pours herself into end up on bookshelves and blogs with not even a hint that she is the woman who wrote the words. That changed with a recent publication. Autumn's name is prominently displayed on the cover of a book that she wrote. It tells the incredible account of a black civil rights advocate who ended up inside a white supremacist hate group. Mississippi Still Burning, From Hoods to Suits, tells the story of James Hart Stern and his path to the unlikely position as the leader of the National Socialist Movement, a neo-Nazi hate group. James Stern is the author, but my guest, Autumn Karen, is proud to say that she also wrote the book, and she joins us now. Autumn, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
I want to hear your story, but talk about James Hart Stern first and tell us about the story that he tells in the book.
So James Stern is an activist and a reverend out in California, in Los Angeles. He ends up wrongfully imprisoned on federal racketeering charges because he was involved in a company that he was the head of. The other people committed wire fraud, but he was the big dog. So he ends up in prison. And they extradite him to Mississippi from California because the wire fraud crossed state lines. So through, and this is all documented in the book, he had previously been an activist and worked out all of these gang negotiations between like Bloods and Crips during the 1991 riots in Los Angeles. But he ends up in prison and ends up all the way into Parchman Penitentiary, which is an incredibly, it's a massive federal prison in Mississippi, and it is home to all kinds of violent criminals. If you see pictures of him online, everybody's talking about his eye has a lot of trouble, and so he ends up in a hospital ward. And the story is long and winding to get there. He ends up in a hospital ward with Edgar Ray Killen. And if you're not familiar with Edgar Ray Killen, he committed the 1964 Mississippi burning murders. And this man is I get chills talking about it. He is a monster in every sense of the word. Okay, and what he does to people of color in the 1960s is far beyond what we can imagine. But James, I don't like the word befriends. James would never call himself the friend of these people, but he certainly advocates for this man because He does not believe anybody should be treated unfairly. So he protects Killen at great cost to himself from other prisoners who want to inflict harm on him, want to make him eat horrible things, want to beat him. So he essentially becomes a protector of Killen and then a confidant of one of the most notorious white supremacist killers in history.
He is, because Killen at this point is confined to a wheelchair, right?
Yes.
He's helping to bathe him as well as protect him. Here's a man who was, it took until 2005 to finally get the conviction for the murder of civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. But he's finally the head dog in that case. Mm-hmm. Who's there, and of course, at Great Rest Parchment Prison, by the way, has quite a history itself as a farm and as a place of the absolute enforcer of Jim Crow. It was post-slavery. So the fact that the feds decided to send him there, by the way, when they had, I think, other choices, right?
They did.
The mail fraud was national. They took a civil rights activist who was a peacemaker in Los Angeles who actually brought peace to various gangs, particularly post-Rodney King, sent him to Parchment Prison. So I just wanted to make sure we underscored that. Then he becomes a defender and advocate for one of the most virulent, violent racists that we've ever caught.
He does. And Killen confessed to James in a series of letters, which are published in our book, dozens of other killings. The atrocities don't even come close to what we see in the Mississippi burning murders. There are worse things, and there are things that we have not published yet that are forthcoming that we're going to put out there. It's unimaginable what happened. And the thing is, it's not in the past. Killen is infirm. He's in his 80s in this prison, and he is still communicating with prison workers. There are prison workers who give KKK signs back and forth, because Killen was the grand dragon of the KKK. He was the owner of it. And in prison, in order to help to rehab the views of the KKK, Killen ends up signing over ownership of the Ku Klux Klan to this black preacher, which is incredible.
So tell us more about how that relationship developed. First, you said, generally that James felt nobody should be treated unfairly. Give us a deeper sense of what his commitment to his faith was that allowed him to take on that role.
Well, James walks in, and when he first meets Killen uses the N-word, uses racial slurs, and that's like the go-to for what he calls James. So there's never a reciprocation of friendship from Stern, from Killen to Stern. But he walks in, and some of it is a function of just human stuff, is that Killen smells really bad. And so he walks in, and they have to share this kind of prison cell in the hospital wing. And Killen just stinks. And so he's like, we have to do something about this. So he rolls the wheelchair into the showers and, takes off Edgar Ray Killen's clothes. And Killen is a big guy. So if you've ever seen there's video of him and pictures of him. He's a big dude. James picks him up out of the wheelchair and showers him and bathes him in the most intimate ways. And that's kind of the start of their relationship.
How did it evolve? Because again, here's a guy in Edgar Ray Killen who is has not a kind thought about African Americans. Now he's being bathed, as you say, in the most intimate way. How did that relationship evolve?
So I want to make it clear that the relationship never evolves. Killen is never at all recondite. He has no remorse for anything that he's done. He never comes to like Stern in any other way. He calls him a dog. He talks about using him like a dog. It's always to use this African-American man to his own ends. And so Stern never has any love lost for Killen, but he does understand that matching hate with hate is not helpful. So,
but he does ultimately confess and then turn over control of his neo-Nazi organization to a black civil rights activist.
Well, that's actually he turns over the KKK. It's after he comes out of prison and he comes out with Edgar Ray Killen's prison card, which is a prized possession, because for us, Killen is a monster, but for neo-Nazis, he's a hero. So when he comes out, Jeff Shoup of the National Socialist Movement, who was a leader in the Charlottesville and is currently, charged with all kinds of stuff relating to Charlottesville, contacts James for Killen's card. And then develops another relationship. So James does this twice. And so the National Socialist Movement was signed over to James Stern earlier this year. And he is currently the head of the largest neo-Nazi group in America.
What's he doing with it?
He is... I actually talked to him last night about it. He is committed to dismantling it. And
well, let's talk more about how you came to be involved in this story.
I was a special ed teacher. And as you know, in North Carolina, we teachers don't make a lot of money. May 1st protests are coming up. I hope you guys are all aware of that. So I needed to do something to help support my family. So I started writing lesson plans, and then I started writing blogs to go with lesson plans. Then that turned into e-books, and then I was able to come home full-time with my disabled daughter and because I was able to make more money writing than I could as a teacher. And then I got signed on to a ghostwriting company, and that's how I met Stern.
You'd done other projects, obviously.
I had. I'd done lots of books before him. James was well aware that... James is a man of equity. That's why he's able to do all these things. And so he refused to have a ghostwriter proper, so he insisted that my name be on the cover. And he and I have become good friends over the last several years.
So what was it like working with him? Because, on the one hand, a ghostwriter, okay, I'm not going to have my name on this. I'm a hired gun. I'm going to spruce up the prose here, and you can go get it published. I get paid. We walk home. This has got to be a different relationship as you get to know this man, or was it?
It was a different relationship. James and I have become, just very close. When I have trouble, I've had hard times in my life, and I call him up, and he calls me up, and we talk, and we have a lot of shared experiences, losing children. We've both been through a lot of various difficult life things that we share and we talk about. And, he's called me up late in the middle of the night, and I've called him up late in the middle of the night, and... he's a great guy. There's the reason he's there. People ask me, what's the trick? How has he done this twice? It is nothing more than being a decent human being.
Well, it is more than being a decent human being, isn't it? Because I think we all figure, there's no way I can do that. So when I hear those stories, when I hear the stories of John Lewis and how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee trained to be spit on and call names, I think, well, I'm out. Can't do it. So was there anything you learned personally? In being that close to the story and working with somebody, how do you do it? Or did you become more confirmed that you could never do it? I certainly would. The more I heard the story, I realized, thank you for being there, because I can't do that.
I don't know. I think it happens with everybody that I write for. I develop a personal connection with a lot of the people. I'm writing a book right now that's an extraordinary story that I cannot say a word about because I have a non-disclosure agreement on it. But everyone who's been through extraordinary things in their lives finds a toughness, and there's like an inner steeliness to them. And I feel like James certainly has that. But then where he hits home and where I hit home with all of my books of these extraordinary people that I'm privileged to write for is they are still like us. That's what makes the connection. So he is extraordinary in that he did it. But then if you were faced with that same thing, I think many of us would rise.
Mm. What about the relationship? You're a white woman. He's a black man. Was that deliberate on his part?
It's absolutely deliberate on his part. He wanted a white author. He liked that I was from the South. Because I have experiences. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina where racism is alive and well. I taught in the North Carolina public schools where racism is alive and well. And he liked that. So
Did you take on the role as a fact checker as well in this case?
So he starts telling me this stuff, y'all, and I'm like, I do not believe any of this. You are making this up. There is no way that actually happened. So if you flip to the back of the book, because I have research experience, I have doctoral work in clinical psychology, so I'm that fact checker. And so I would go in, and he'd tell me this extraordinary story, and then I would frame it in the New York Times and in research journals because it's all real. And in the three years that I've known James, he has never even come close to a falsehood.
Wow. Has this changed things for you as a ghostwriter? Are you going to be more picky about the stories you choose after writing such an extraordinary story?
I was always picky about, I've written some things that I'm not proud of. I wrote for some presidential candidates in the last election to pay the bills that I'm not proud of. I don't have to do that anymore. And I'm fortunate for that. I think the best thing about it is that I get to tell more interesting stories, and I get like more interesting people come up. So I have people solicit me now that I'm like, that's an amazing story. Let's tell it together.
I was going to ask if it does something for you as a ghostwriter to have your name elevated and on the cover.
It absolutely does. And it's I don't like taking credit for things. I like that I get to be kind of on the back end. I'm writing a book for a family called The Death Era right now. That's a family that lost their child to gun violence. And we're working on it from all four of them. That's a privileged work to be able to write. I just wrote a novel for a production company. It's looking for a publisher. It's a cross between 50 Shades of Grey and Bridget Jones's Diary, which is an extraordinary piece.
We'll have you back for that.
Absolutely. So I like to write varied pieces. You know, a lot of them have similar things that go through them, but because I have kind of a broad life experience myself, I connect with a lot of people. That's just fun. Like, I love doing it.
Mississippi Still Burning, what do you think is the impact? Have you had any sense of whether or not? I mean, we just had Robert Lee up here. We've had a powerful message of reconciliation over the past 32 minutes here in this past 32 minutes. Do you think it has broader impact?
I think it does. I think that realizing how ugly things still are is important, but then at the same time reaching across and realizing those are still people. We don't understand our white privilege, and that's the absolute truth. I walk through it, and I'm a single mom of three kids. Nobody questions if I have a baby daddy. Like, they don't question it. They assume that I'm a divorced mom who's raising kids by myself. If I was a black woman, that's not how the narrative would go. And so I think that we're recognizing that more, but it's also because we're seeing the ugliness more. And that's what James is doing. What happened in Charlottesville was really ugly. And that's what he is working to promote right now with the National Socialist Movement. These people are real. Jeff Shoup is like a name on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. He's also a real person who has a real story, and his backstory is incredible. And you can understand why he got where he is by looking at his past. So,
Autumn Caron is the author of, actually the writer of Mississippi Still Burning, From Hoods to Suits. And you can find out more about her and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Autumn.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, after day, after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched black people going to jail, black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it is could be lessened if black people simply voted.
We want to look now at Mr. Biden's bid for the race for the nomination and how Democrats may respond with Democratic Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware. She endorsed Joe Biden's candidacy today. And Amy Allison. She's president of She the People. It's a group that advocates for women of color in leadership positions. She is not supporting a specific Democratic candidate in the campaign. We welcome both of you to the NewsHour. Congresswoman Blunt Rochester, to you first. You're right out of the box saying you endorse Joe Biden for president. Why? Why is he the right person for 2020?
Joe Biden is the right person for such a time as this. I've known Joe for 30 years as Delaware senator, vice president, but also as a friend. And when I think about his taking this step, I think about the past, the present, and the future. First of all, just the past, the record of accomplishments that he brings to the table. The present, that we are living in a time, as his video showed earlier today, where incidents like Charlottesville are happening and where we are seeing just an abuse of power. And so he's focused on the present, but also because he cares about the future of this country. And so I'm excited. Many of us, not just here in Delaware, but across the country, are excited about the campaign and feel that Joe Biden is the person that needs to be our next president.
Amy Allison, how do you look on Joe Biden's candidacy?
Well, it's interesting to talk about past, present, and future. Joe Biden had the benefit of high name ID in his association with President Obama, which makes him beloved amongst African-American voters, particularly African-American women who are the highest vote turnout Democrats and most loyal Democrats. But we really need to talk about also the past association with Anita Hill. And, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of questions about his relationship to not only black women, but women of color in general, associated with how he handled the Anita Hill hearings back then, but also just a couple of weeks ago, how he handled the accusations of improper behavior toward former Nevada legislator Lucy Flores. I think that's the present. And I think the future is really going to depend on you've got a candidate with high name ID who's entering into a very different world. This is a Me Too era and a Black Lives Matter era. You know, how is he able to appeal to a broad range of very enthusiastic key Democratic voters in the places that he needs to in order to gain the momentum? Mm-hmm. I think that that question is still out.
Well, let's take two of the things that you just mentioned. Congresswoman Blunt Rochester, what about how he handled Anita Hill in 1991, being a very tough questioner of her when she was raising questions about sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas, and what's happened in the last few weeks?
I think for Joe Biden, you know, I had the opportunity to have a conversation with him. I actually requested 15 minutes. I was granted a half an hour. But we stopped and talked for 2.5 hours about a lot of issues, because he believes as well that this is not a fait accompli, that this is something that he has to earn. As was said by Amy, black women are the loyalist Democratic voters. We are the active Democratic voters. And we have also said that we want a seat at the table. And so I think what people need to look at as we go into this next couple of months is a few things. Number one, his experience. What? Number two, what are his policies? And number three, who does he hire? Who does he bring around the table as well? The things that I can acknowledge for him is that I just want to say this one last thing, is that what he does that is different than our current leader is that he acknowledges areas he needs to grow, and he moves forward and tries to grow. That's something we're not seeing right now in our president.
I want to come back to Anita Hill. The New York Times is reporting today, this afternoon, that Anita Hill is saying she did receive a call from Joe Biden. His campaign is saying he called to apologize. She's saying, and I'm quoting, she was deeply unsatisfied with what they talked about. Is that going to linger as an issue, Amy Allison?
Yes, it will. Anita Hill was a young and very courageous law professor. When I was in college watching the way that she was treated for standing up and speaking out, he allowed a lot of damage to happen in the decades since by having a cooling, a chilling effect on women, black women, and women everywhere in the country who dared to have the courage to speak out against harassment that they received at work. I think there's an accounting that needs to happen on the part of Joe Biden to directly address it. So it starts with a simple apology, but needs to have very important plans that go with it. I mean, it's good that his campaign called, but if Anita Hill's not satisfied, well, I'm telling you, for women of color, we're not satisfied either.
Congresswoman Blunt Rochester, just quickly, what is it that you believe Joe Biden needs to do in order to help people come around to his explanation and his apology?
He has acknowledged that if he could go back and do it differently, he would have. But he also made sure that there were women on that Judiciary Committee so that a person would not have to face an all-white male Judiciary Committee. And I think the voters are going to really have to decide if the actions, because he has a long record, he has a long track record of many, many accomplishments, but there are also things that he has acknowledged he would do differently. And it's going to really be up to the voters to decide. And it's also going to be incumbent upon him. He wants to earn people's vote. He wants to do that.
I just want to ask both of you, finally, in an era when there are younger candidates, female candidates, candidates of color, why is Joe Biden the right choice here or not? I mean, how much should it matter that he's older, that he's white, and that he's a male? Amy Allison?
That's a question we asked the eight presidential candidates as part of the She the People Forum yesterday. We had candidates like Elizabeth Warren. The senator walked in to a lukewarm reception, and 20 minutes later, standing ovation, she'd won over the hearts and minds of the thousands of people in that room. Bernie Sanders walked in to huge applause and left with a tepid response. And I think what we're going to find as Joe Biden enters the race, that he is really that we could see public opinion, we can see the opinion of these key Democrats, women of color, change as he goes into these series of debates and public appearances. And we'll see, because women of color are looking for strong advocates for gender, racial, and economic justice. And the question is, can Joe Biden earn his vote in a crowded, rich field of strong candidates?
What about this question, Congresswoman Blunt Rochester?
Well, I'm an example that representation does matter. And it is important that we have a seat at the table. I think what Joe Biden has demonstrated over the course of his career is, whether it's on the issues of civil rights, whether it's on the issues of human rights or women's rights, he stood up. And also, whether it's about strengthening our economy, he stood up. And so what I would ask the voters and what I would ask the American people is to stay open-minded, to see his heart, see what kind of message he puts forward, and let him earn your vote. He's already earned mine.
All right. We want to thank both of you, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware and Amy Allison of She the People. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Man, this shit worse than cancer, like a fucking disease. Living a nightmare, they telling his dream. Look what they did to Martin Luther, bullet holes in our kings. And they wonder why we never believe. And they wonder why we never will leave. Nigga, we poor. Young niggas worrying about that corner store, but the chinks on that. And you claiming that's your block, who you think on that? Quicksand in the hood and we gonna sink on that. You should think on that. Poison water out in Flint, they let them little babies drink on that. They don't care about us.
Clean drinking water from your tap. Many of us take it for granted. Not in Flint, Michigan, though. 5 years ago today, officials in Flint switched the city's drinking water source. That set the stage for what would become a crippling lead crisis. Since then, residents have seen their children's blood lead levels spike. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports.
It all began with an optimistic toast on April 25th, 2014.
Here's to Flint.
Here's to Flint.
Here it is.
With plastic glasses filled with tap water, Flint Mayor Dane Walling and other city and state officials toasted the switch of the city's drinking water from Detroit's water system to the Flint River. It was done in an effort to save the struggling city millions of dollars. It ended up instead throwing Flint into chaos and costing the mayor his job. And several of those who toasted the switch that day were indicted on criminal charges stemming from what would become the Flint water crisis. At first, Flint's nearly 100,000 residents complained their tap water was undrinkable, cloudy, foul-smelling, tasting of chemicals, or worse. That was followed by multiple E. coli outbreaks, and eventually the city acknowledging it was in violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But government officials persisted in defending the water as safe to drink. Increasingly, Flint residents didn't believe them, taking to the streets, demanding the city return to Detroit's water system. It took a year and a half before government officials finally did switch back, after independent testing revealed that improperly treated river water damaged pipes, releasing lead into the city's drinking water. It was only revealed after the city's drinking water was switched back that a Legionnaire's disease outbreak had killed at least a dozen people during the switch. There are conflicting scientific opinions as to whether the Flint River water was the source of the outbreak. In the past few years, 15 city and state officials have been indicted, about half have cut plea deals, no one has gone to jail, and the remaining criminal cases are stalled as Michigan's new attorney general tries to decide how to proceed. Meanwhile, multiple civil lawsuits against state and federal agencies and private contractors are grinding their way through the courts. After the switch, Flint was left with thousands of damaged water pipes, families surviving on bottled water, and a city's psyche damaged.
We are going to do some highlights today, freshen you up.
Yeah.
Stylist Dan Basile is talking with a client at his new hair salon in downtown Flint. Dan and his husband, David Custer, opened their business last month in a rehab print shop. Custer, who's also a local TV news anchor, says they wanted to build their business in downtown Flint, in part because the city is better off now than it was before the water crisis.
I say, and we joke now, that we have some of the best water in the entire country now. We have brand new pipes throughout our entire city.
And the persistent social media hashtag Flint still doesn't have clean water just isn't true. Tests show Flint's tap water now falls well within federal and state standards for lead, even better than many other cities. Even so, residents are still advised to use filters on their taps as pipe replacements continue, since lead particles can still shake loose. Federal and state funds are helping Flint fix its broken water system. That, in turn, is attracting business investment. City official Lynette Phillips says this year, the city has about $200 million in new business investment coming in, from new auto parts manufacturing to a new culinary school.
Of course, no one would ever want to experience this travesty that the city of Flint experienced, but we have to be where we are and to move forward from that.
But while businesses are moving forward, many city residents are having trouble doing so. Flint resident Melissa Mays has been one of the loudest voices during the water crisis. She remains involved in lawsuits and activism.
In some ways, we're better. In other ways, we're forever poisoned, damaged, traumatized. That's not going to ever be better.
And it's clear that Flint still faces a long road to recovery. For example, it will be several years before studies currently underway can assess any effect on the cognitive development of thousands of young children who drank the city's lead-tainted tap water. Many say it's these children's future that may determine if Flint will truly emerge stronger from its water crisis. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody.
Right. As far as the lead goes, you know, this...
Well, that's
this,
your hometown.
Well, this is...
Flint, Michigan, back in the news. And, I mean, you've been, of course, I mean, you've been amazing to your home state, your hometown, your whole life.
I just want to say thank you for that. But this is not a lead issue. This is not even an infrastructure issue. This was a decision made by a Republican governor to give the rich in Michigan a $1 billion tax break. And then when they had $1 billion less dollars in the budget, it was like, okay, what are we going to do? We got to cut back on services. Well, anybody got any ideas? Yeah, let's take Flint off the drinking water from the Great Lakes and make them drink from the Flint River, so we can save money. Within a few months, they realized they were poisoning people, and the word came down, don't say anything, doctor the books, and they let people continue to drink this water and did nothing about it. And I think that is a crime, and they did it. I know they did it because it's a black city, it's a poor city. They wouldn't do this to Bloomfield Hills or Ann Arbor or Grosse Pointe. This was a hate crime. It was a hate crime based on this race hatred of this particular party.
There have been environmental disasters in white cities. Love Canal was not black.
Yeah, but who really, once they discover Love Canal, that they've got a problem, everybody starts to work on it to try and fix it. Not in Flint. They went another 9 months hoping nobody would pay any attention because, oh, these are just a bunch of black people.
Lead poisoning has been a major concern in cities like Flint, Michigan and Newark, New Jersey. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 500,000 children in the United States between the ages of 1 and 5 have elevated lead levels in their blood. Our country's struggle with lead has a long and dark history, and it goes beyond our water supply. Much of it starts with the paint that's on millions of Americans' walls.
If you look at the history of where lead was placed in the United States, most of it is in aging lead paint in aging homes in the United States. There are millions of homes that are coated with old lead paint. And that really is, in most cases, the primary source for most children who are exposed to lead.
That's Christopher Wirth, the senior editor for WNYC News. And his reporting on the history of lead paint and its prevalence in the U.S. today is featured on WNYC's newest podcast, The Stakes. I asked Christopher to take us through the story of lead in the United States, beginning with our present day.
I think people have a general idea that there may be lead paint in their homes, but what I don't think many people realize is that that old lead paint creates a lot of lead dust. So this is not just about kids who eat paint chips. It's not just about keeping your kids away from that paint. That paint can create a lot of lead dust that ends up on the floors, on the windowsills, and that really is one of the primary routes of exposure for a lot of kids in the United States.
You met with a family in New York who are dealing with this issue. It's a mother and her young children. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
After a while, I keep seeing them with this white stuff on their mouths. I'm like, what's going on? Oh, mommy, the paint from the wall. I'm like, why y'all eating the paint from the wall? That's not nice. That's nasty. I took them to the doctor to get their physical done for school, and the doctor called me back with the results. The kids have lead poison.
Christopher, how is this able to happen in New York City?
So this woman, she's part of a program in New York City that actually helps survivors of domestic abuse find an apartment and pay for that apartment that's kind of a refuge. But this place turned out to be anything but, because the woman's children, as you heard in that clip, had started to pick away at this old aging lead paint on the windowsills. You know, I went into this apartment and there are actually bite marks on the windowsill. The thing about this whole lead situation is that the lead that went into paint is called white lead. It naturally has a very sweet taste to it. And so once a kid gets a taste of that, they want to taste a little more, they want a little more, they want a little more, so they keep eating it. And so in New York City, we have a lot of old apartments, old homes that still have a lot of this lead paint. And that's true in many cities across the United States.
You spoke with a public health historian who told you a little bit about the history of how the industry knew what it was doing.
Yeah. So here in New York, up at Columbia University, I met this public health historian. His name is David Rosner. And he has been looking at this issue for a really long time, since the 1980s.
Each gallon of lead paint had about 16 pounds of lead in it. Half the container was lead.
I mean, people in general knew that lead was dangerous from the very beginning. I mean, the ancient Greeks knew this. Benjamin Franklin wrote about the dangers of lead a long time ago. And the lead industry, the memos and the company records that David Rosner found was that not only did the lead industry know that this material and that the products they were making was dangerous, but they created a marketing campaign to convince people that this product was safe because of that natural fear of it.
Now, you've also spoken to David Rosner about the fact that this also had a racial component to it. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
They say this in their memos. The only people who are really victimized by it are Puerto Rican and Negro people, and we can't do anything about that unless we really rebuild the housing. Ho-ho, that's not going to happen. Or alternatively, and they say this, educate their parents not to let them eat lead. And how does one accomplish that task, they say? How can we ever educate them? You know, this was an indication of the racism of a culture.
I've seen the memo that he's referring to in that clip. And what that is the head of the Lead Industries Association, a man named Manfred Bowditch, was writing to the former head of the Lead Industries Association, who at the time had become the Assistant Secretary for Mineral Resources under President Eisenhower. And they're responding to an article in Parade magazine that was talking about lead poisoned children. And each time these articles came out, the industry would try to respond in kind. And in that particular memo, they're trying to portray this as something that really did only affect Black Americans, affect Puerto Rican Americans. The fact of the matter was, those were the communities that were suffering the worst, particularly around the middle of the 20th century. So that particular memo was written around the 1940s, 1950s. And at that time, when you have white flight, people moving to the suburbs and these inner city neighborhoods where landlords had really left buildings to crumble, that's when this paint becomes even more dangerous because it's peeling off the walls, it's chipping off the walls, and kids are even more exposed to it. And so the industry really tried to pass this off as something that only affected them, and there was nothing that we could really do about it.
So federal government is turning its back at this point. The industry is targeting Black and brown children, specifically Black and Puerto Rican children. Who steps in at this point to make sure that someone does something?
At that time, in the late 60s, early 70s, you have this next phase of the civil rights movement. The Young Lords, you have the Black Panther Party. Those groups were actually going out into their communities. They were addressing these medical issues. And so around lead paint, the Young Lords, they actually obtained test kits, and they were going door to door up in East Harlem, for example, trying to warn parents about the dangers of lead poisoning. I met this a former Young Lord. His name is Carlito Rivera.
And we would have literature ready to explain that we're testing because this system is trying to kill you.
I think that what happened at that time, and David Rosner says this, is that they were really bringing this issue to the forefront of people's consciousness. They were saying, pay attention to this. There was a man named Herbert Needleman, who was a pediatrician from Philadelphia. He had been working out of Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, treating kids for lead poisoning. You know, at that time, people really only thought of lead as something that damaged kids at high doses. He started to wonder, what is it doing at these lower doses? And so what he started to do is go to schools and dentists throughout Philadelphia, and he started collecting baby teeth. Because what we know is that when lead enters the body, it acts a lot like calcium. It's what scientists call a bone sinking element. And so it ends up in your bones, it ends up in your bloodstream, and it ends up in your brain. But if it's in your bones, he knew that it was also in these kids' baby teeth. And that was a way for him to get a picture of what a large group of kids in Philadelphia had been exposed to over many, many, many years. As you might expect, the black children in Philadelphia had much higher levels of lead. But what they also found was that just in general, kids had been exposed to a lot of lead, no matter where they lived and no matter what their race is.
Christopher, was the fact that Dr. Needleman was able to identify that this was a problem not just in black and brown communities, but also among more affluent white children, was that the turning point to make this an issue?
You know, a lot of the people who were involved in these studies, and one of them is the dentine expert in Philadelphia who actually analyzed these teeth and published with Needleman. And he really did say that he thinks that that's why the research got so much attention, is because, you know, counter to the story that the lead industry was telling, lead was ubiquitous. It was really everywhere because it wasn't just in paint. At that time, we were putting large amounts of lead into gasoline, and that was being burned and through tailpipes and in the atmosphere, and we were all breathing it. So the average lead level in 1976 in a child was about 15 micrograms per deciliter, which is considered very high today. Today in New York City, if your child tests at 15 micrograms, the health department gets to your house pretty quickly.
Christopher Wirth is a senior editor for WNYC News. Christopher, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Tanzina.
You can listen to more about the history of lead and how it impacts us today on WNYC's newest podcast, The Stakes. Find a link at thetakeaway.org.
The Man Knot: Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood.
A star NFL player has been barred from his team over suspicion that he abused his 3-year-old son. The Kansas City Chiefs say wide receiver Tyreek Hill cannot take part in any team activities, including off-season workouts. On a newly released audio tape, two people, said to be Hill and his fiancée, discuss a police investigation into the child's broken arm. On the tape, Hill's fiancée accuses Hill of causing the injury. Joining us now is NPR's Tom Goldman. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ari.
Catch us up on the background to the story. I understand prosecutors initially said they would not file any charges in this potential case of child abuse.
That's right. The DA said he thinks a crime was committed against the child, just couldn't prove who did it. So on Wednesday of this week, there were no charges filed against Hill or his fiancée, who I should add is also now pregnant with twins.
And now there is this audio tape. Describe where it came from and what's in it.
Yeah, it emerged the day after the prosecutor made his announcement about no charges. It was first played on a local TV station in Kansas City, KCTV. And it was described as a tape made in March while Hill and his fiancée, Crystal Espinal, were walking through the Dubai International Airport. Now, we haven't independently verified that it's actually Hill and Espinal, but the tape is out there. Nobody has denied its authenticity. In fact, the Chiefs, Hill's teams, say they are deeply disturbed by what's on it. The whole tape is about 11 minutes long. We have a couple of short excerpts. On this first one, Espinal appears to accuse Hill of breaking their son's arm. Hill speaks first, and the child's name, I should say, is bleeped out on the tape.
I didn't do nothing.
Then why does he say daddy did it? Why does he say daddy did it?
I don't know. He says daddy does a lot of things.
Like what? A 3-year-old's not going to lie about what happened to his arm.
Now, Ari, in this next clip, Hill appears to threaten Espinal. Here it is.
He is terrified of you. And you say that he respects you, but it's not respect.
Me.
It's terrified. He is terrified of you.
You need to be terrified of me, too.
So, Tom, what have prosecutors said about this tape?
We haven't heard anything publicly from the prosecutors, but there are a number of reports out today, Ari, that the DA has reopened the case in light of this new audio tape.
And what about Tyreek Hill? Has he issued a statement?
He has. He released a statement saying in part, quote, "I love and support my family above anything. My son's health and happiness is my number one priority. I contacted his lawyers today. They declined to comment because of what they called confidentiality laws. They have said, though, that Hill maintains his innocence and that he has cooperated with law enforcement."
Tom, this painful and upsetting story is unfolding in the middle of one of the NFL's biggest offseason events, the NFL draft. So yeah. What's the impact?
That's right. Well, the draft goes on, of course, but this is the kind of publicity the league obviously hates, especially, as you point out, in the middle of this crown jewel moment that the NFL always loves as a way to, you know, keep sports fans consumed by the NFL even when there's no football being played. So bad PR again for a league, you know, that seems to often deal with controversy.
And also for the Chiefs, which has dealt with this problem in the past.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Chiefs are one of the best teams in the NFL. They almost got to the Super Bowl last season, but controversy has been following the Chiefs even before this week. Kansas City star running back Kareem Hunt, he led the league in rushing yards his rookie season in 2017, and last year he was videotaped shoving and kicking a woman, and he was released by the team just a few months ago. Also, the Chiefs just traded for a top defensive lineman, Frank Clark. He was arrested on a domestic violence charge in 2014, kicked off the University of Michigan football team. And let's not forget, Ari, that Kansas City drafted Tyreek Hill in 2016, knowing that he had pleaded guilty to a charge of domestic violence against his then-girlfriend, who is now his fiancée.
That's NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Ari.
For years, the singer Kate Smith's version of God Bless America has been played at New York Yankees and Philadelphia Flyers games.
God bless America.
But no longer. Last week, a fan alerted the Yankees that Smith also recorded at least two racist songs in the 1930s. NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas has more.
Since September 11th, the Yankees have played Kate Smith's recording during the seventh inning stretch. And the Flyers took her as a good luck talisman after she sang the Irving Berlin Classic before they won the Stanley Cup in 1974. There was even a statue of Kate Smith in front of their arena in Philadelphia. For decades, Smith was an incredibly popular and patriotic figure. During World War II, she raised $600 million for the war effort. And in 1982, 4 years before she died, President Ronald Reagan awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
It's been truly said that one of the most inspiring things that our GIs in World War II, Europe and the Pacific, and later in Korea and Vietnam ever heard was the voice of Kate Smith.
She recorded dozens of albums and hundreds of singles. Among those recordings were two songs whose lyrics are really problematic. In 1931, she recorded a song called "That's Why Darkies Were Born." Someone had to slave and be able to sing, "That's Why Darkies Were Born."
That's why darkies were born.
That was a pretty popular song in its day. Even the pioneering black American singer Paul Robeson recorded it. The other Kate Smith song was "Pickaninny Heaven." Last week, the Yankees announced they would stop playing her version of God Bless America. On Friday, the Flyers did the same. And yesterday, they took down their statue of Kate Smith. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
120 years of history suddenly destroyed.
Five churches with black congregations have burned in Alabama this year. Look at some of the damage in Greene County.
This is one of dozens of southern, predominantly black churches that burned within the
last
year and a half.
Just last week, somebody torched this church in the nearby town of Tyler.
President Clinton now wants to know if the fires are racially motivated.
What's painful to me, as we look at the story today,
They're burning churches again.
A crowdfunding drive to raise money to rebuild three black Louisiana churches destroyed by fire has raised more than $2 million. The son of a local sheriff's deputy has been charged with arson and hate crimes in the case. For the pastors of these churches, this Holy Week has been a time for guiding their members through difficult times. Reverend Gerald Toussaint is pastor of Mount Pleasant Baptist Church in St. Landry Parish, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could I ask you to start by taking us back to April 4th? Where were you when you heard the news?
I was on my way to work, and my wife calls me, and she said, Mount Pleasant is, they said, they told me Mount Pleasant is on fire. I said, oh, no. So I turned around and went to the church, and it was on fire. It was almost gone.
That must have been hard, considering that your family has ties to these churches going back decades.
Well, yeah. My daddy pastored for 21 years. And I've been there for 13 years.
As we mentioned, there hasn't been a trial or conviction yet, but there's a long history in this country of attacks on black churches. As someone who knows your community well, did these fires come as a surprise?
It came as a surprise to us because we didn't expect none of that going on around here because we are a community of people that stand together. And I don't know if it's really racial or spiritual. Just after the black church, after the church in general, I really don't know. But I know that the way that the country's been going lately, people have been emboldened to do things they had never done before in a long time.
This past week, as you know, the world's attention was captivated by the fire in Paris at Notre Dame. I understand it was after that that the money started flowing in to help your churches rebuild. How did it feel to see the sudden increase in support?
I understand Notre Dame. It's a hurtful thing to see any church, anywhere be burned. But to my understanding, Notre Dame was an accident. Our church was intentional. Someone took time to set fire to three churches in St. Landry Parish, and for us to forget about it, to let it go. Every church that's open in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is important because some reach a large crowd, but some reach a small community, and that's what our churches are. We still need to hear the word too.
Reverend, what do you think should happen now? I understand you and your congregation have talked about forgiveness for the alleged arsonist.
Yeah, we got to forgive him. I feel for him because, he's so young. He don't know nothing about the civil rights movement. He doesn't know nothing about lynching. He doesn't know nothing about racial violence. He don't know that. That young man is 21 years old. What does he know? Only what people feed him. Hatred and envy and strife. And if you keep feeding people with that, then it's going to turn into a whole lot worse than three churches.
Easter Sunday is about resurrection, rebirth. What is next for your church?
Rebuilding. Because that's what Jesus does. He rebuilds lives that have been torn apart. He rebuilds. And that's what we're going to do.
That's Reverend Gerald Toussaint, pastor of Mount Pleasant Baptist Church in St. Landry Parish, Louisiana. Thank you very much.
God bless you. Have a happy Easter.
When you're a cop, you can shoot a motherfucker by the trailer park. Plenty of evidence, sure defense, when we raise a shot. Then turn around and taste a perp for the blazing perp. I'm a cop.
As we reported earlier, for the first time in nearly three decades, a former police officer in Florida was sentenced to prison time today for shooting to death an African-American man whose car had broken down. The killing in Florida is getting national attention, as have a number of cases of police conduct and questionable shootings in recent years. But as Amna Nawaz tells us, most cases of police misconduct are not in the public eye. A new investigation finds tens of thousands of officers have been investigated or disciplined over the last decade.
Reporters around the country from the USA Today Network and the nonprofit Invisible Institute spent more than a year compiling the largest database of misconduct records. They found at least 85,000 officers have been investigated or disciplined for some 200,000 incidents of alleged misconduct, much of it previously unreported to the public. Most were minor infractions, but there were still thousands of more serious cases, including allegations of excessive force, rape, domestic violence, and drug dealing. They also found frequent dishonesty. The database uncovered more than 2,200 instances of perjury, tampering with evidence or witnesses, or falsifying reports. And 32 people became police chiefs or sheriffs despite a finding of serious misconduct, usually at another department. James Pilcher is one of the reporters for that USA Today network. He works at the Cincinnati Inquirer and joins me now. James Pilcher, welcome to the News Hour. Let's start with those records. How hard was it to get access to that information in the first place?
Well, in many cases, it was difficult. We had to sue in some cases. The police unions and so forth have been able to make it very difficult to access some of this information. And we still feel like we've only scratched the surface. We've covered maybe, a tenth of the total agencies in this country. We probably got data from about 700 to 800 different departments covering 80,000 officers. Well, there's 750,000 officers in this country at 18,000 different departments. So we're just getting started.
So you mentioned in some cases unions stood in the way of getting to the information. In a typical police force, in a typical environment, what usually happens to those records of misconduct?
Well, in most cases, they're filed in their personnel file, although in some cases they actually have a separate file that you might not know as a regular public citizen for discipline versus their personnel file. That's the case sometimes here in Cincinnati, for example. And then it stays with their record. But in some cases, the unions have been able to negotiate and have some episodes or discipline taken off their record after five or seven years. And it sort of cycles. If you're on good behavior for a while, the bad behavior falls off. So if a bad incident may not be reported or may not be known in their file anymore after 10 years or so.
So we mentioned there were some serious cases, obviously, that you uncovered there. But in that range of behavior that falls under misconduct, where did most of the cases fall? What kind of actions and behavior are we talking about?
Well, if you look at the data that we published nationally, we published lists from 44 states of all the different officers who have been decertified, basically lost their license to be a police officer. The majority of those, more than 10%, were for drugs and alcohol abuse. But there were another 10% that were for domestic abuse, and there was another good portion of those that were for dishonesty or perjury. So, you know, it runs the gamut from, you know, insubordination all the way up to excessive force to felony convictions.
You highlight this one incredible story I have to point out. A police officer in one town gets fired, then he gets rehired as the police chief in another town. How does that happen?
Well, the mayor of that town openly admits that he didn't check very well, and that actually happens more than you would think. We found that to be a fairly common occurrence because people in these small towns are so desperate for police help that sometimes they just take what they can get and don't really check very hard. All it would have taken is one phone call from this small town mayor to this other town less than an hour away. And I literally say his personnel file at that at that department is this big. So I've seen it myself. So he was actually fired twice from that department and reinstated by a mediator. He was convicted of a felony. He crashed a police car. The list went on and on.
You also highlighted a few cases of officers who were what you called consistently under investigation. Almost 2,500 who've been investigated on 10 or more charges. 20 individuals who'd faced 100 or more allegations. All of them kept their badges. Did you have any better understanding of how that was allowed to happen?
Part of it is that the system of police discipline in this country is so localized and balkanized. It's a state-by-state, municipality-by-municipality endeavor. So it varies from place to place. Even from state to state, it varies. So you could actually get decertified in one state and then actually go apply and get a badge in another state. So that we found that happening quite often as well.
Just a few seconds before we go, James, I wonder if you can just tell me, this was an enormous undertaking, right? More than a year's worth of work. Why do you think it's so important for this information to be out there?
Because the public really doesn't have a way to have an insight into the people that are supposed to be protecting us. And so this was a way for us, there are other agencies who do collect this data, but they don't make it public. This is a way for us to take it to the public and say, okay, especially in this day and age, where we're having such a debate over policing and police tactics, that we felt that this was the right time to do this.
James Pilcher of the USA Today Network, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Because they killed a white man the other day, same day.
Oh, Jasper, Texas. He killed
the one that everybody was demonstrating. A bunch of black people went down there to demonstrate in Texas when that happened.
Yes, sir.
You know, saying black people can't get no justice and all like that. See, but but you've got to keep in mind the big picture. The white supremacists work on percentages. See, now they put a lot of focus on the Troy Davis thing to send a message. That's what that's about.
A message to whom?
To black people and to white people, because this is just about election time. That's all this is about. This is just some stuff to back up people who are white men who are running for office. See, otherwise, they could have played this down simply by not even mentioning Troy Davis at all, except as a footnote. I mean, it'd just be a little blurb in a local paper down there. But they blew it up so that everybody had caught the attention of everybody in the world. Well, see, but that's about just the election. They know how to play things up, they know how to play things down. They could have played up the white guy getting executed if they wanted to play that way. You know, people just caught that kind of in passing. A lot of people didn't even remember Mr. Byrd being dragged behind that truck or never heard it in the first place.
21 years ago, in the East Texas town of Jasper, a black man, James Byrd Jr., was murdered by three white supremacists. Byrd was kidnapped while walking home in the early morning hours of June 7th, and what happened next shocked the conscience of the nation, indeed really the world. This afternoon, one of the men responsible for that horrific violence, John William King, is scheduled to be executed by the state of Texas. NPR's Wade Goodwin covered this story back in 1998 and covered the subsequent trials. He's here with us. Hi, Wade.
Good morning.
And I do want to give people just a moment here to step away if they don't want to hear what I'm sure will be some graphic details that could upset some people. But could you take us back to 1998 and when this happened?
Yes. What happened was three men, white men, driving around in a pickup truck late on a Saturday night looking for trouble, saw a 49-year-old African-American man walking home. They stopped and offered him a ride, and James Byrd Jr. knew the man behind the wheel, who was Sean Berry, and Berry invited him to get in, and they said they'd take him home, and so Byrd did. But they didn't take him home, and they took him out to the woods. I think Byrd thought they were going to go have a drink together, but they all got out, and eventually they attacked Byrd. They beat him with a baseball bat. They taunted him. They urinated on him and finally chained him by his ankles to the back of that truck and drug Byrd 3 miles down a paved road until he was dead. And then they got out, gathered up a few of the body parts and dumped those in front of an African-American church where he was found later that Sunday morning. Now, Jasper's a very religious East Texas town, which meant that much of the black population were worshiping in their various churches around the town when the news of what had happened spread. And as you can imagine, it tore through that black community like wildfire, and people were devastated. They were horrified.
How quickly did they catch the men who did this?
Pretty quickly. The FBI was called in, the Texas Rangers, and law enforcement caught 23-year-old Sherry Bond and John William King and 31-year-old Russell Brewer quickly. They'd left behind evidence that pointed right to them, a wrench that had Barry's name on it, lighter that had King's prison nickname on it. And King and Brewer had met in prison, and they were avowed white supremacists. And King had racist tats all over his body, including one of a black man hanging from a tree. King and Brewer, they were the main perpetrators, and they got sentenced to death. Berry testified for the state. He got life in prison. And Russell was executed 8 years ago, and the day before he went to the chamber, he said he'd had no regrets, and if he was given the chance, he'd do it all over again. But today, it's Bill King's turn to die.
Well, what has happened in this community over these two decades since then?
Well, in the white community at first, there was a lot of denial, blaming the media for making them look bad. But, you know, after a while, the media went away, and Jasper was still left with the reputation of being a hateful place, and that affected everything. Businesses wouldn't move there. If you owned a house and you wanted to leave, you had a hard time selling it. Saying, you know, we're really not like that, just didn't matter. You know, for the last 20 years, Jasper's had this crime hanging over its head, but that's also forced the white community there to look in the mirror in a way that most white communities haven't had to. Of course, not everyone's been willing to look. You know, lynchings here were as prevalent as the worst parts of the Deep South, and that legacy of white supremacy endures.
NPR's Wade Goodwin. Wade, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
He covered the kidnapping and dragging death of James Byrd Jr. and the subsequent murder trials. 44-year-old John William King is scheduled to be executed in Huntsville, Texas this evening at 6 p.m. Central Time.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 27th, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, questions about any of the segments that we heard at the beginning. There is a new number to dial for the broadcast. The new number, according to whites, 605-313-5113. 64. The code is the same, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. New number again, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get started. I am curious how many people heard of the race soldier who was executed this week down in Jasper, Texas. Just to see if that made, you know, headlines. With all of the terrorist attacks this week, the synagogue attack that happened in Southern California today, they said that was near San Diego. So I've been told events still unfolding, as well as the attack in Sri Lanka. With everything that's happened the week of what they call Easter Sunday and then Passover, with all that, the religion of white supremacy, admitted white supremacists executed this week down in Texas. Did folks hear about that? With that segment, I am thankful that they included details. It's my experience. Most of the time when James Byrd Jr. is discussed, or let me, two things. First important point, most of the time when I hear James Byrd Jr.'s name mentioned, it is minimized and the focus is to Matthew Shepard. They'll say the hate crime bit, it'll be Matthew Shepard killed, victim of a hate crime. Oh, and James Byrd Jr. Most of it. And sometimes they don't even mention James Byrd Jr.'s name. We did a whole program on Matthew Shepard and saying, no, not a hate crime. This was probably just a race soldier. Maybe he was gay, who was into criminal drug activity, not killed because he was quote unquote gay or LGBTQI or any other letters that you want to add. We did a whole program. Evidence does not add up. Check the archives, 2016, The Book of Matt. Excellent read if you want to get more details. But that's number one. That's most of the time when I hear James Byrd Jr.'s name mentioned. Number two, I don't hear all the details. It'll just be, oh yeah, he was lynched in Jasper, Texas, 1989. Two Towns of Jasper is really good. You should check out that documentary if people are looking for. Reading is more important than watching television, but it's a black filmmaker. Lots of great information. I've played some of the sound clips on the program before. Check it out. Anyway, but it doesn't give all of the detail that you heard in that segment, that he was beaten with a baseball bat, that Mr. Burt, victim of racism, white supremacy, that he thought they were going to go have drinks. That moron says at the end of each broadcast, I think, what is it? Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. And the reason given is race soldiers, they mistreat a lot of black people, but they especially take advantage of a lot of black people after they have poisoned us with their narcotics. They don't include those details that he was urinated on, beaten, bludgeoned with a baseball bat, and then they leave out all those details that they took the remaining carcass and dumped it in a black cemetery. Sometimes I have heard it where they dumped the carcass on a black cemetery, what was remaining, and then urinated on the remains. I've heard it that way too, but either way, most of the time, all those details are discarded. Oh yeah, James Byrd Jr. That's why I say racism, white supremacy gets sanitized. And this is not ancient history, 1998? Man. Anyway, I also, every time that I hear this case now, I'm reminded of the late Dick Gregory. The Cow's Decade, the second time Mr. Gregory was on, there were protesters in Jasper from people who opposed the death penalty and did not want the killers of James Byrd Jr. to face the death penalty. The late Dick Gregory was one of those protesters. He went down in 2011 because, as you heard Mr. Fuller, they did kill one of the co-killers, co-white supremacists in 2011, same week as Troy Davis, as a matter of fact. And Dick Gregory went down to protest, and we talked about it. That was June 2011. You can go back in the archives, and I play sound clips from that broadcast on a regular basis. He talked about John Brown and the killing of James Byrd Jr. and what he thought would be better than a state execution. But I'm always reminded of that when I hear James Byrd Jr., the execution. And my last thought on this for the time being, that segment with Mr. Fuller, I think it's appropriate beyond this case. Racists do a phenomenal job of how they focus attention. I'm pretty sure that the execution of Mr. Byrd didn't get, especially this week with all of the killing that went on and terrorist attacks left and right, I'm pretty sure it would be easy for that one to be forgotten about if people heard about it anyway. As I said, I don't think that got as much attention as Matthew Shepard, even though both names are on the so-called hate crime. But I think that's William Clinton. I think that's his one of his products from his legacy, his presidency. Continuing, other things before we get to listeners, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Enormous gratitude to all the listeners who have supported, kept the Cows broadcasting for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. Other things before we get to the callers, we had a listener who wanted to donate camera equipment. I'll just read directly. I'm a photographer looking to donate used and new lighting equipment to a group or person of color, non-white, free of charge. a group or person interested in photography or video lighting. Most of the equipment is in good condition, and any info needed to use the equipment can be located online. I like to contribute to a non-white group or person that could be interested in learning more but may not have the funds to buy such products. I can send images and send equipment free as long as they send you, if they like, or the mailing address. I'm a person of color trying to give back to a group or individual person of color. And they have their contact information so that I can email and all of that. So if you would be interested, if you would be interested in free photography equipment, photography, video lighting, email me untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com, and I can, you know, forward your contact information, and seems like you'd be willing to get it out to you free of charge. Let's see. Additionally, the Cows Yoga Retreat, Labor Day weekend, the dates would be August 29th through September 1. Labor Day is technically on September 2nd, that Monday, as they tell me, but we'd be going till Sunday. So it'd be Thursday through Sunday, 4 days, 3 nights, Lake Arrowhead, California. Chef Nadira, she did all of the meals, plant-based meals for us when we were in Virginia. We got rave reviews. She said she'd be down to make the cross-country trek. We started very late with the planning. I'm just now recognizing that you have to plan a little bit earlier for summer events. People have lots of activities scheduled, especially parents, lots of activities scheduled for summertime and in particular holidays. So-called holidays in the summertime. So hopefully we started early enough. Again, in the future, we'll be way earlier to make sure that we are solid. But if you are interested, Labor Day weekend, plant-based meals, yoga, counter-racist workshops, obviously discussion about white supremacy racism, and I'm sure workplace racism with all victims of white supremacy, no whites around, private beach, great facilities, no mud, beds for all. Drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com and just put Labor Day Retreat in the subject, and hopefully we'll have enough folks and we'll be able to do it up Labor Day weekend in California and then Florida for December. Drop an email if you need more information about any of the yoga retreats. One thing I will say quickly, someone had told me I should write a book about what my experience has been practicing yoga, since it's been such a bizarre occurrence to be displaced and doing this because of the flood and all that, and then all the racism that's occurred within that, and said that might be something to do to kind of make notes of everything that's happened over the past year and a half or so within all of that. One thing that I can say, I do think I see a constructive value to doing things, getting in locations where victims of racism, white supremacy, particularly black people, where whites have worked hard to prohibit or to deny us access to getting there, just so that you can learn. I think a huge aspect of what being a victim of white supremacy is about, what Mr. Fuller says being a nigger is about, is having a very small grasp of the world. Very limited understanding of the universe, not thinking in a universal way about life and your existence, to have a very, very limited way of thinking and a very, very limited amount of information about everything. So to try as best we can to get to learn, to be curious, to explore. The system of white supremacy does so much to discourage and make it difficult for us to get out and explore. But that's really the way of thinking that we should have. Curious, scientific, I'm exploring. I want to try to learn as much as I can about lots of different things, and being in places where non-white people, especially black people, generally are not, or generally are not allowed to be. Next. if folks have seen any interesting information, I've been trying to follow, but I mean, it's difficult because I'm trying to get the broadcast together. The shooting at the synagogue shooting, I did see reports where they were calling it a hate crime. The suspect was captured alive. They didn't release any information about the person, so I'm assuming it's a white person because they would have identified and had pictures up and everything. It was a black person or a non-white person. But they did call it a hate crime. They didn't call it an act of terrorism, so I'm also assuming that this was a white person who went out and did this, the synagogue shooting. But if folks have any pertinent information or anything that they've seen since that happened, that would be good to know. Wow, so many. They said that they were talking about the powerful black female voters. And they were talking about Joe Biden. And hopefully it seemed from that report that black female voters will use their power for Joe Biden. I'll say again, Trump 2020, 4 more years. Do we have any black females? Because they said that Joe Biden is beloved by black people and in black females in particular. Do we have any black female callers with Joe Biden is your beloved? Is that true? Any black female voters here? Any black females? I guess even if you didn't vote, Joe Biden, he's your beloved. Do you know any black females where they just swoon about Joe Biden? I would like to know. Next, the segment where they spoke with the white ghost writer. She's doing the book about this black male. He's been placed in greater confinement in Mississippi with these hardened criminals, where he's trying to do the correct thing and has solved these or made gang truces in Los Angeles and what have you. Number one, very important, white ghostwriters. I've talked about that for years. We've had guests who've talked about that. The power of whites who are not named, where they get to function with autonomy. Maybe some things they say are true. Maybe they're not. Who knows? You don't even get to interrogate or identify who the individual is. Extremely important, the role of the white ghostwriter. And even the word choice. Now, this is a white woman who I'm sure gets paid pretty well to do what she does. And she says, racism is alive and well. I'm going to say that that's a metaphor. I have no idea what that means. It's I think if I could put one of the fancy terms on it, it is anthropomorphizing racism, making it seem like racism is some sort of animal or being as opposed to something that white people, individuals classified as white, practice. Very different thing. Racism is alive and well, and that is a cliche saying. And then she follows people of color when she was talking about the race soldier in greater confinement that he committed the 1964 Mississippi burning murders. James Chaney, black male, and those two white boys. That's the way I've said it for years. That he did things that were way worse than that. Totally believable in a system of racism, white supremacy. I mean, you don't even have to tell me. I already believe, you know, that that's been done. Probably still being done. Jeffrey Dahmer. Why would I think it's not happening? But she says he did things way worse to people of color. I thought that was a deliberate act of racism. Non-white people all over the universe are mistreated. Absolutely. System of white supremacy. But in this case in Mississippi 1964, I don't think this was black and brown people being mistreated. I don't think this was black and Asian people. I don't think this was any other group of non-white people. And that is important. If this was just black people, then say that. Let's identify specifically who it was. I do the same thing if we're talking about another group of individuals. Let's identify exactly who it was as opposed to being nebulous and make it seem very general as opposed to them. This was very focused terrorism on the Negras. Next. Edgar Ray Killen. I wrote his name down so I could be specific. The race soldier, Edgar Ray Killen. When they talked, and I say they because it wasn't just the white ghostwriter, it was also the white announcer. They both echoed, they repeated the sentence. This black male bathing Edgar Ray Killen, bathing him in a most intimate manner. That was added, and then the white interviewer repeated that sentence in my book for emphasis, or in my view for emphasis. I immediately thought of the delectable Negro, another form of black consumption, making the black, and they, that's written specifically in the book, Vincent Woodard, where he talks about psychic consumption and consuming, sucking the life force out of black people, where you are being used to nurture and nourish this white man, this white savage who's killed who knows how many people and terrorized all these black people. And the sexual nature, this just the way that it was said, delectable Negro. I was thinking, why are they interviewing this white woman as opposed to the black male? I would much rather hear him. And that sort of thing happens on a regular basis as well. We talked about that, where white people, they become the authorities, the experts, the very voice of black people, non-white people. When she was talking about how white people don't understand their white privilege, that was another one where I said, I think that's a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy. And especially I thought she was lying, because when she said it, she followed that up. She said, and that's the absolute truth. Anytime that I hear a white person add that sort of emphasis, really to any sentence, any sentence, that's the absolute truth, that they have to make some real point of emphasis. Like, yeah, this is definitely true. I'm definitely, master deceivers. Let's really interrogate to make sure what I'm hearing is accurate. And that one was absolutely false. And in fact, she demonstrated her understanding of racism, white supremacy by giving an example immediately following. And she chose such a tacky illustration. She said, I'm a white woman and I have three children. People don't see me and think I'm some baby. Where's your baby daddy at? Even to have that's her representation of how she would be treated, or how she thinks of black females, just having children, have baby dad. That's her representation of racism, white supremacy. It's not that I could be denied a loan, that I'm a white business owner and I would be denied a loan. It's not that if I were an author, people wouldn't think of me as that. It's just, no, I'm a mother and I would be thought of as, oh, baby mama, where's your baby papa at? Maybe I could be wrong, but I thought that was a great or significant representation of how she thought of racism, how she articulated racism. She also mentioned Jeff Shoup and encouraged people to check his credentials at the SPLC. That's why I thought it was so important, the report about them also being accused of practicing white supremacy racism. You can't produce a white person who is ignorant about racism, white supremacy, because so many white people get accused of practicing racism, white supremacy. How could you be ignorant about this process and be constantly accused of practicing it in so many imaginative ways? Next, when they talked about the, I guess this will be my last one. They talked about the enforcement officers and the surprise that they can be fired and rehired or have allegations of misconduct, or maybe they're misbehaving and it's not an allegation. And then they can still get promoted and get these new jobs. We've heard that. I think that was the case. Officer Lohman, Tamir Rice, wasn't that him? He worked at another police department. And they said he was terrible. He was awful and he shouldn't have a gun. And he just moved 10 miles down the road and picked up a gun and a badge. And there we go. I get to kill as many Negroes as I want. Maybe he moved and did the same thing again. They said that with Daniel Holtzclaw, that this was standard operating procedure. White people, Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com. He says white people don't get fired. They get transferred. This is not a surprise. This is not news. And I thought when he said that it was the white male, that he didn't get fired or there weren't suspicions about his previous work conduct, he got promoted to chief of police. That's not strange. That's not bizarre. What I thought was, wow, black people that attempt to go to the bank to cash a $5 check and they have to produce, you know, a blood sample, DNA test, birth certificate, grandfather's birth certificate, shackles from a great grandmother. I mean, to cash a $5 check and you've got these. They were even the excuses that they made. I guess I just didn't check. I thought that right there reveals a lot, because I suspect the background checks that they do for employment, I have a strong suspicion that you have a lot of white people. They do not perform background checks on white employees. Because we were talking about that workplace racism, how the policies and procedures do not apply to black employees. I strongly suspect that that is one aspect that gets greatly downplayed. That's how you end up, because that's a statistic that's been longstanding, that white people with a criminal record have a better chance of being employed than black people with no criminal record and, I believe, a college degree. That's in Pipe Dream Blues, Clarence Lussain. He was a guest on the program June 2010. But that's like standard procedure. That book is old, and those statistics are still valid, unless I've been misinformed. They're just not doing background checks on individuals classified as white. Maybe that's a question that we should ask, see if we can get more information on that. Anywho, if you could take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, suggestions, that way everybody who dialed in will get at least one chance to speak. If you have additional comments or questions, if you could wait until everyone has shared at least once, that would be greatly appreciated. For this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, as I said, racism is alive and well. I think is a racism, and an inaccurate racism as well, unless they were going to alter it to say we have many individuals classified as white who are alive and practicing racism well. But no metaphors. Race soldiers frequently, deliberately employ metaphors, analyses, analogies, comparisons to practice deception. They will insist that two separate concepts or entities are identical. And frequently, they are not. This is how racists deceive. Victims of racism like myself, we have been exposed to this misbehavior for years. It has impacted our thinking. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, we don't have all of the logic to articulate our views on certain subjects. So sometimes we will use a metaphor, analogy to articulate our views. Frequently, this just contributes to more confusion. If we could be direct, exact, specific about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. If we need additional time, that is allowed. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. The number, one more time, new number, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, if we have black females, Joe Biden is your beloved. Please dial in and let us know. What does that even mean? And how did he get that status? Joe Biden never. Anyway, if we have any black female voters and or black females, period, Joe Biden is your guy. Please, please, please let us know. And I reckon it'll count if maybe that's not you, but if you know other black females. So if your grandmother, your mother, daughter, sister, niece is just smitten with Joe Biden, got pictures of him up in the house, ringtone is Joe Biden, please let us know. I would like to know how this infatuation went down. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. This is Red in Nevada. And no, absolutely not. Joe Biden is not my beloved. I don't even know what that means. But the only, just a few things I wanted to say. No update on the case involving or regarding Jasmine Barnes. Of course, it is, you know, racist and white racist, suspected racist, were very quick to name two black males in the killing of Jasmine Barnes, but no update since January. About the segments, and the segments actually will lead me to a piece of local news. but the segment regarding the Louisiana church bombings, where Reverend Gerald Toussaint from Mount Pleasant Baptist Church, he said the young men or the young white man didn't know what he was doing. The civil rights had occurred and all those things like lynching had occurred before he was born. I thought that was, you know, interesting, but I'm starting to learn the more that I listen to the cows. They do suspected white supremacists, they do purposely put different black people or, you know, on the news or what have you, if they are going to say what white people want them to say, not saying it, basically if they may be confused. But basically how that is referring to the article that I have to share is back in March, on March 20th, because I still have the article, I had made reference to the two white men, the two young white men who were at Arborview High School, which is in northwestern Las Vegas area, who were making terroristic threats. So they did finally arrest the second one. In this article, the article I'm reading from, it's from VegasNow.com. It's the CBS Channel 8 affiliate. It says the second teen was arrested. One was 15. I think the other one was either 14 or 16. And basically, in this article, they did interview one of the moms of the black teens who were put in these posts. And it's a black female. She was basically, you know, talking about the posts. And the good thing about that news segment is that she actually had screenshots and she was holding up a poster board of what the post said. And I'll just read you one. So one of the posts said, and it's a Twitter post. So the handle is Arborview Niggers, because they didn't blur it out that much to where you can't tell what it says. But it says it's from Arborview Niggers NV. It says, "God, just seeing these niggers infuriates me. I just want to go Columbine part two, but only to kill the effing niggers. I can smell the effing melanin." So that's one of the posts that these 15, 16-year-olds posted, but Columbine occurred in 1999. This is also before these white people were alive. So that whole lie of white people not knowing anything that happened before they were born, that kind of, it doesn't make sense. But I'll mute my line. Thank you.
He pointed out the melanin specifically in his outrage. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. And the worship, that's Kevin Dutton, Wisdom of Psychopaths, the Cows Book Club. On display. We're reading Sundown Towns right now. Thursdays, I don't think we're quite at the halfway point. I could be, like I said, the chapters are kind of wonky in the book, but we have made a little bit of progress. Interesting read, White Man Practicing Racism. But the book club, Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths, that what Red in Nevada just mentioned, that worship of Columbine, this is the 20-year anniversary of the Columbine shooting out in Colorado and having so many whites. They just had that white woman last week. She went up to Colorado, had been buying a ticket, was expressing the exact same thoughts. Mr. Fuller and others have talked about just that sort of psychopathic mind state and how prevalent that is in a system of racism, white supremacy that necessitates violence, death, especially at those who have melanin. Others who dialed in with a hand up, *61, if you have questions, comments.
Can I be heard?
Mr. Ken Steele in California, do you have any info on the synagogue shooting? That's right, pretty close to your area.
No, I have nothing to say about that. Sounds like business as usual out here. Yeah. What I wanted to say was, something occurred to me Earlier this week, I was speaking with some suspected white supremacists, and they started that whole line of discussion that is very typical with them, where they will go to a black person and they will start talking about their need to just listen, or their need to be educated as to, you know, what we're experiencing as we move through the system of white supremacy. And, you know, to this white person, I said, you know, look, I'm not interested in having any discussions with any about race or racism. And when I say race, I put that in quotes because they're really talking about racism. And I told them, look, I don't want to have any discussion about racism that isn't centered around how do we punish racists. And after that, after I said that, this white person did not want to speak with me at all again. And they seemed very, very, very interested in having long, drawn out, pointless conversations about racism that are designed to either absolve them of guilt or boost their self-esteem about their position in the system of racism. But the moment you turn the discussion into one about what do we do about them, that's when they don't want to have any discussions. And, you know, this was something that Neely Fuller talked about, but it just didn't become super real for me until I, you know, practiced one of his techniques, and I just got straight to the doing. And yes, they don't want to have that discussion at all. If you do have that discussion, or if you do prompt that discussion, you will likely be met with a lot of resistance, or, you know, just some sort of emotional outburst. That's how this interaction ended. They blamed me for, you know, having a bad attitude, and you know, put all sorts of you know, negative labels on me and some of the things that I've said. And yes, they pretty much disappeared from my life. From my life. Yeah, this person, after I asked, you know, hey, why don't we have a discussion about what we do with these racists, they completely disappeared from my life. So if you want to stop being bothered by racists who want to steal your energy by asking you a whole bunch of pointless questions about racism, you know, just ask them, hey, you know, let's focus this conversation about how we punish racists, as opposed to how I feel about this discussion or how I feel about the situation. And be as indignant as you want, because that's your opportunity to. I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you.
What should be done? What should be done? And just asking questions, something that we've talked about regularly. I know Mr. Fuller talks about, he's got questions recommended in the book, in the code book, but questioning white people. And I have heard similar results from other victims of racism when they question white people about racism in a serious manner. They tend to flee. They tend to lose their white friends rapidly. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61, if you have commentary. If we've not heard from you at all, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter. Hey, the officer that got convicted this week, just because this came up before, in Florida, he was sentenced to 25 years for killing the officer. This was the fellow that we discussed before. We thought he might be a non-white person. Did you think he was non-white?
Oh, yeah. Non-white person.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Matter of fact, most of the incidents where a enforcement official is arrested, convicted, and sentenced, a non-white person that is being rendered that punishment. Yes. The DCS program went back into sessions after the week off from the last weekend, that holiday, quote unquote holiday, religious holiday. I did notice when I showed up, which I'm not surprised. I was eventually over time, as the sessions itself becomes more and more popular, more and more people are going to be aware of its existence, and in turn, it's going to attract people. I did notice a white female brought her non-white children. I'm assuming it's her non-white children to join in on the sessions. I'm more so not speaking about the non-white victims of racist white supremacy that are black males. I'm specifically targeting the white female. She was, she observed for about maybe 30 minutes or so. But the DCS program carried on and carried out its mission and its normal vocal as well as activities as though she wasn't there. In turn, my activities today with the younger black males, I went over the definition that Mr. Fuller speaks about with the system of racism, white supremacy, what it is, his definition, because it's short and to the point, and I didn't want anything to be, you know, long as far as that concerned, because we just don't have the time doing the different activities that we do. Basically what took place, one of the segments of the session was we divided the multitude of young fellows up into groups of 12 with a one or two quote unquote mentors, although I don't identify myself as such, but nevertheless, and basically that's what I talked about. A particular, first I sat, you know, just asked them questions and had them to participate by them giving their thoughts and meanings to what is the most negative relations that people have on the planet. And eventually one of the boys actually stated it, racism, you know, emphatically, like, you know, he was just like waiting for it to get around to him, you know, as far as that concerned it. And it enabled me to open up the discussion on the subject. And I gave that meaning, and in turn, I went over all nine areas of activity. We got as far as religion, I believe. Yes, we got as far as religion before we had to move on to something else. Basically, what I did in the process was ask each one of the 12, what their thoughts when they hear the word economics, education, you know, one by one, and then I would give Mr. Fuller's compensatory definition for the word, and we would talk about it, you know, a little bit, you know, each one of the people activities. So that's basically what took place today and the significance of doing the week. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
High commendation to retired firefighter for sharing constructive information with non-white children, black children in the Sunshine State. That is super needed. We talked about that for a decade, the importance of giving accurate information, what racism is, how it works, definitions to children so they can get that information as soon as possible and incorporate that as they develop. So that is spectacular, going over all the areas of people activity and just outstanding. Hopefully they can continue with that conversation. And exactly what you said, I think Dr. Welsing and other folks have made that same observation that children are not stupid. As Dr. Welsing would say, they do have a brain computer that generally functions well. They can see what's happening. Racism, white supremacy.
Yes, sir.
What's happening? Like, note what happened in Florida. Oh, officer just got convicted for killing a black fella. Yes. And the governor's race. My goodness, we just had Ron DeSantis and all that. Can't be monkeying around in the state of Florida, as he said. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie in Louisiana. Oh, the church fires.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, when the pastor was talking about the young man doesn't know, you know, I just felt bad for the pastor because he doesn't understand how much the 21-year-old white male understands or overstands, as a matter of fact, his role in the system of racism, white supremacy, and finds it to be probably a duty and an honor to scorch a place of worship, which is, you know, supposed to be one of the most neutral places there are as far as any type of society goes throughout the world. So I felt remorseful for the pastor. In regard to the lead situation, I do believe that there has been purposeful and tactical implementation and use of lead where they know we reside, because they have to, it's part of the process of literally dumbing us down through biological warfare. My son, years ago, he really liked Thomas the Trains, so he had plenty of them, and there was a recall on all the red trains. We sent it back, they sent some new ones, and then they were recalled again. And I'm like, how do you make the mistake twice? And in my opinion, you don't. So there's that. And I was blessed because he doesn't, at the time, and he never did, he never put toys in his mouth like most other children do when they're teething. So I was able to, you know, I'm able to thank God and say that he hasn't gotten, as far as I know, any lead poisoning, addicted to whites. I thought about how we are addicted to whites when my mother divulged her entire name to a white lady who proceeded to be trashy towards me at an office space. We were waiting on an appointment, and the white lady pestered me to find out what I was reading, which is the compensatory code. She was like, what are you reading? I said, ma'am, I don't think you like it, and I don't want to share. She said, try me. And I said, no. And she said, please. And I'm sitting there like, would I be able to do this to her? Absolutely not. So she gets into a conversation with my mother, whom she knew predatorially would, you know, oblige her in some sort of dialogue. And after it was over, I asked my mother, why did you tell this woman your whole name? She was like, I don't know. It's what I do. I said, you've never told anyone your entire name. This is the first time I'm witnessing. I said, well, what did she tell you? She said, well, she told me her name. I said, yeah, but did she tell you all of it? And she said, no. I said, come on, I'm just trying to help you. I wouldn't tell you if I didn't love you, you know? So in regard to Mr. Bird, I was young, very young when that happened. And I think I was maybe around 13 or 14, and I felt terrorized within my own self, finding out that not only was the man murdered, but, you know, that his head came off. And I just knew from then on that the quote, don't mess with Texas, oh, they mean it. And I don't. You can't pay me to go to Texas. You can't. There's no part of Texas I would want to be in. And the sheriff the head sheriff, what is it called, the whatever it is, the head, you know, nigga hunter in charge. I'm sorry, that's a metaphor, but he said that during the investigation, when they found all the parts, he said, I was hoping, and I quote, that it was another black man that killed him, end quote. And that's on YouTube. And I was like, wow, like, what do you make of that? I don't know what to make of that other than the crime is so gruesome. You're hoping that not even a white supremacist did it, which just, again, just exemplifies it's beyond terroristic when they get ready. And then the last thing is the report on the teacher. I went ahead, I called the dean, I told her what happened. I said, I'm going to be forwarding the teacher's initial email that she sent to me to you, and I'm also going to be emailing what the teacher told me per the conversation. So I went ahead, sent that to the dean and the assistant principal, who is also the assistant superintendent of the district. And so she said, well, I'm going to have to interrogate all the children, and I need to talk to your son. So she talked to my son. She called me and told me she talked to everybody in the class, and she said something that I found to be informative. She said, I don't know what the consequence will be. So in my mind, that certifies or validates that they understand something incorrect has happened. But she said she didn't know what the consequence would be, and then she added that the teacher would like to know if she can apologize to your son. And I thought, wow, you know, to the last minute, you are going to still continue to maintain your position in, you know, objectifying and lusting after my son and apologize to him? No. I told her, no, there's no way in the world. I tell you what, tell her to apologize to me. I want to hear what she has to say, and she can apologize to me. But she can't talk to my son ever again, and I think she knows that. So since she's still on a, I guess since she's still feeling like maybe she just made a mistake or something, I'm going to help her learn that she did more than make a mistake, and I am going to bring up this incident at a school board, the soonest school board meeting. And I want to thank everybody that advised me on what to do. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, Gus, and have a good night.
Real quick, Irie, just for folks who maybe didn't participate last week, she dialed in last week and she was telling us about an incident with her son who's in school. We had a white female teacher, of course, that's 70% of the workforce, white female teacher who was making comments about her son, and maybe he's depressed, maybe something's wrong, and, you know, he's not wearing his arms out. He has those athletic, muscular arms, and he's not wearing them out anymore, and just making these really inappropriate, delectable Negro type comments from this white woman teacher. And so we were offering suggestions about what to do. What you said that they did take your son out of her class. Did they just give him like a new teacher or what have you? What was the resolution?
Yeah, there was a schedule change as well. So he's out of that class. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you know, he has to also change his day. But yeah, they took him out right away. And then I forgot to say this when I spoke to him again, he mentioned that, like, that day that I sent the email, she made an allusion to something in Shakespeare, something they were reading in Shakespeare about seamen, not like sailors, but like seamen. And then she was like, you get it? That's what he said. I wasn't there, but I don't have no reason not to believe him. So she's really out of control.
Delectable Negro. I think I talked about this last week. There are lots of illustrations of this. Jerry Sandusky et al. Mary Kay Letourneau right here in Seattle. Many illustrations take that very seriously. And again, this is why when you have those 200 conversations, males and females, and, you know, oh, you look great. You look great. Let's get to the bedroom. Dr. Welsing, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. Have extensive dialogue about your child's academic plan, what it's going to look like for the first 10 years. If not, that's what you will be sending your black child, black girl, black boys. That's what you'll be sending them to. Probably a white woman lusting after them. Other folks who dialed in, if we've missed you totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. First, I guess on a technical note, I was calling the new number and putting in the passcode, and every time I pressed pound, it told me that it was denied. But when I didn't press pound, then the call went through. I don't know if that's my line or if any other people who have had that situation. So you may or may not have to press pound after you put in the code, the 564-943 code. I don't know. Like I said, it just happened on my phone. Joe Biden is not my pal. I think if someone especially did not want him to be president, I would probably suggest that you talk about all the laws he created around the three strikes type legislation, because I believe he was heavily involved in that. And because the one thing that a black, I believe, maybe just me, because I am a black woman, wants more than anything is a black man. And he has taken these black men away from us. So, you know, you can do that and get him out of there. I don't think any sensible black woman would go for that. But, you know, VGQ on people's opinions with that. I appreciate the, I don't know, I'm sure you may have done this on purpose, but the, I guess the environmental clips, especially since it's about Earth Day and all that, I guess that just passed. And I know it's probably not seen as an environmental threat, but having a stink white person next to you in the cell and no one's taking care of him, and then, you know, you just have to solve the problem yourself. So to clean him up and all of that. And then the ghostwriter thing, I agree with you. You know, like you said, a lot of times we think there are a lot of ghostwriters behind the books with black people, and this actually brings up more suspicion towards that, which is unfortunate, because some believe some of the black people really did, things really did happen to them. But because of the system we live in, sometimes we have to be suspicious, and that's unfortunate for them, because I'm sure they are really just trying to tell whatever story or share whatever experience happened to them. Unfortunately, that's just the environment we're in right now. I appreciate the Flint update, and that strategy of fixing up the downtown and the black people in the non-downtown areas suffering, that is commonplace. That especially happened during Katrina. I saw that firsthand. I wasn't there for the hurricane in 2005, but I went about a year and a half later, around the time that is March Madness, so late March, and they already had part of the tournament there in the downtown New Orleans area. So they are quick to rebuild these downtowns. So I guess that's a pattern that people should look for, how fast is the downtown of some type of area rebuilt. And I think when we talk about Mr. Byrd and his murder, how it shocked the nation's consciousness. I don't know if we talked about that as a metaphor per se, but when I heard, I'm like, well, what does that mean? Because things seem to keep going on. I don't know who's shocked. I'm sure personally his family was shocked, because that did happen in their family, and, you know, all sympathies to them forever. I'm sorry that happened to their family, but, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm upset. You know, you still get upset. You still want to, you know, fight against racism, things like that. But I don't know how shocked I personally am anymore about these things that are happening. I don't believe, especially the shock of America, which really means white people. I don't believe they were shocked either. I guess they were shocked they caught the people so quickly, maybe. But other than that. And thank you. Nothing further at this time.
Much obliged for sharing. Yeah, that is a metaphor. Conscience of the nation, that absolutely is a metaphor. Yeah, thank you for pointing that one out. And it is upsetting, all of it. I remember we prepared for James Byrd Jr., I think, by reading and talking about the case and some of the other similar cases. And I was disturbed hearing the details. It is disturbing. So it's I can certainly understand being upset. It's something to be upset about. And just understanding that, if anything, that is what it means to be white. That is a tremendous illustration right there. Participating in those type of activities, the cover up of those type of activities, that does exactly what we're reading about in Sundown Towns. James Loewen, and how many times that's not an isolated incident, that's over and over and over again.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to say quickly, I did hear about the execution, the recent execution before this program. I think it came up on USA Today. I haven't really been watching the news or the cable news like I have been in the past, but it did come up. So I did hear about it before this program.
Much obliged. I did ask people that question too.
I'll be hurt.
Greetings, Thomas, in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Get to my notes. Joe Biden, man has no chance in an election against Donald Trump. Now, they're bringing up this racism against Anita Hill. I don't remember black people caring about this when he was used as the white racist to legitimize the election of Obama. For those years, I mean, he was you know, they're cool white guy. They're a non-racist white guy. Now all of a sudden this is being questioned. It's really odd. And then black women are saying they want to use this as their chance to get a seat at the table. So, you know, what kind of seat are they trying to get at? Because from the way Joe Biden's being presented by some of his victims, he doesn't seem like someone, if I was a woman, I would want to sit next to. You know, who knows what he'll be asking me to do. The white ghostwriter, who sounds like she could have wrote The Hate U Give, Baby Daddy. Sounds like the John Wallace story, where, you know, he practiced racism his whole life and then some black guy took care of him in his dying days when no one else would. If it wasn't John Wallace, it was Strom Thurmond, but I'm almost sure it was John Wallace. But did I hear this film say that it's a black person that he left in charge of the KKK or something? Or without my ears receiving me. The lead poisoning in Flint, and amongst other things that's inside their water, that's probably even worse than lead poisoning. Terrible. In New York City, they have given, the federal government has given the city over $2 billion to take the lead paint out of the housing project, which, you know, was funded by the federal government. Most of the projects in Manhattan. Now, that's a daunting task because, like I said on a previous show maybe a year ago, in public housing in New York City, it's the same amount of people that live in the entire city of Milwaukee. So it's a lot of people that live in housing, almost 700,000. So, but after taking all this money, they ran out of the money and found out that they didn't even complete the job. And there's still parents who have these walls failing. They just did a big story on it on New York One News the other day. They went into a lady's house, black woman, of course, and her kids were just diagnosed with lead poisoning from the paint. And then when they go in her house, it's just peeling off the wall. And then, of course, the next day they sent someone there to repaint the house. So they don't care, you know. The church burnings didn't get the attention of Notre Dame burning. The church shootings get a lot more attention than the Dylan Roof shootings. And he assassinated a senator, Clementa Pinckney. So I see today they had another shooting at a synagogue. Very odd, because when I saw this story come on, it was like 5 o'clock. And they said this happened at 11:30, and they had no details, no pictures from the scene. And when they finally and show pictures. It just looked like a normal day. It just doesn't seem right. Not saying it didn't happen. It just doesn't seem like something that happened the way they're saying it. The cop getting hired. If he had a felony, how could he become a police officer? I'm quite sure that they don't hire police officers if they have felonious stuff on their records. They say that he was charged with a felony on the last police force, and then he goes to become the chief at another police force. So for sure, they did not do a background check. I could see them even like missing the regular misconduct, or whatever's in his record, if they call and speak to someone who vouches for him, probably a friend of his, or you know, white people look out for each other. However, how do you miss a felony? That sounds like something that would come up pretty much on a Google search, really, if you really wanted to find out. Even though it doesn't seem like white people get mugshots, because I still haven't seen a mugshot of Robert Kraft or none of these people who were involved in this case. And where their mugshots at? How come we don't see their mugshots ever? James Byrd, I saw the story earlier this week, I think 2 days before the execution, and it stood out because it's so odd that when I saw his name, I was instantly looking in the headline for Matthew Shepard's name, too. So I said, oh, this is just about James Byrd, so I clicked on it, and they went into the details of the crime, not as several as the clip he played. That was a good clip. But they also said in the article that another person was already put to death for his murder years ago, or a year ago or so. And he's the second person to be put to death. And there's a third person who got life. So he must have been a snitch on the other two. Just wanted to inform people, they have a new Wi-Fi standard coming out. They have a few new ones coming out, but this one is, I found, very important for black people. It's called 802.11az, Next Generation Positioning. This is advanced LIDAR technology. The opposite of radar is going to be shooting lights out and be able to give you the position in that way. Sort of like a 3D version of Google Earth, more of a 3D version. With certain software that they can implement with this technology, they'll be able to look into your house, see through walls, see through bricks, see through cinder blocks, most metals, with this technology. If they have a warrant, you know, they could just look through your walls now, see what's going on before they go in. It's going to be used against us quite severely, I'm sure. And I'll mute my line, Gustin.
No secrets in the system of racism, white supremacy. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943#. Press *61. If you would like to participate. Thank you to the caller who mentioned about the difficulty with dialing in, where I guess she pressed pound and had problems and then did not press pound and seemed to work out. I think some other people had noted some perhaps funny business when attempting to dial in usual suspects. But thank you for, I always appreciate folks letting us know, because I myself have had problems dialing in, and it's been a decade of interference in attempted counter-racist broadcasting. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
Gus, can I say something really quick? It'll literally take 30 seconds.
Oh, I'm going to count. Yes, hear it.
Thomas from New York had mentioned something about the mugshots, and in one of the plantations that I worked at, I actually had to speak to a white woman, and she said that she was actually upset because the business that she paid to take her mugshot off of the search engines, they weren't doing it in the speed in which she wanted. So white people, they also have that ability to just pay to get their mugshots, either not at the top of the searches or to get them removed. Thank you.
28 seconds. Red in Nevada. Yeah, I'm sure they have the resources, because sometimes it'll cost you, you know, if you have $1,000 or whatever to spend to get that sort of to expunge your record, so all of that stuff disappears, or maybe they don't charge you to begin with. A lot, they got system of racism, white supremacy. I think George Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, since they talked about they're no longer going to play the white woman's racist rendition, was it God Bless America, whichever national anthem, that George Steinbrenner, I think he's a convicted felon, unless I am mistaken. Like, and he still owns the Yankees, one of the most powerful white men in the country. System of racism, white supremacy. Other folks that we missed totally. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I did want to make sure that I got in the Louisiana black minister, victim of racism, white supremacy. He certainly has VGQ. Absolutely. I do too. He said what he said about forgiveness and white people not being informed, all of that. but I did appreciate the point that he made in making the comparison. Talked about those comparisons at the beginning. I thought he made a brilliant comparison. The Notre Dame fire, that was an accident, a tragedy, you know, terrible, as he said. However, this was deliberate. What happened to our church? This was an act of racism, white supremacy, white terrorism. If we are outraged about an accidental fire, as we should be, we should be equally, if not exponentially, more outraged about a deliberate act of white supremacy against a black church, no less. Excellent point, I thought he made. Folks still spectating, or other folks that are with us, I guess if you have a hand up and missed out, have a question or comment that you want to add, proceed. Again, if we have any black females, black female voters, Joe Biden is your beloved. Make sure you dial in and let us know. And has anybody heard any programs that focus on black male voters? I don't think I've ever heard a program, unless it's talking about, man, they are disenfranchised. They do not get to go out and vote. And I have never heard a program where they're saying, wow, we have got to go out. Donald Trump is going out to get black males. We're going out to, you know, I've never heard that. If anybody has heard that report or read that news article, I'd like to know about that as well. Other folks have comments.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Irie.
I haven't heard anything in regard to black male voters, except the only thing I hear more than anything is how they can't vote because they're felons. Most of the time, that's the dialogue. But black women are the spotlight of, you know, voting, and they don't even really get into like new voters for that fact, or elderly or senior citizens in among black people. So there's that. I forgot to mention during the James Byrd, about the James Byrd segment, the man said that the white supremacists were riding around looking for trouble. And that made me think, perhaps we should stop saying that, as non-white people looking for trouble, for people that are looking to be trouble, because I think now that is a metaphor that is incorrect.
Words are important. Appreciate that, Irene. Other folks who dialed in, if you haven't spoken at all, we have about 30 minutes left, so just don't wait till the last minute if you have questions or comments. Other folks who, if we did hear from you, if you have additional thoughts, feel free to share.
Have you heard? You can go ahead, ma'am.
Oh, I can wait. I already spoke before. I'll wait. Thank you.
All I guess call her in Florida. She's yielding the floor. Red in Nevada, she's already spoke a couple times now.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the story about the, I think that's the non-white law enforcement official that I guess has been put to the death penalty or whatever, I think. And that being the first police officer to have that done to them in, I think, 3 decades. Is that the amount of years, Gus?
I think it was like 25 years.
Or something. Oh, 25 years. Okay. And that is significant that it does look and appear to me that the person is non-white. But I'm going to also add in with confidence that, like, given the amount of police reports that I've seen in Florida, it seems like there is this phenomenon where non-white people are being documented on paper literally as white like the letter W, or it'll either be white, black, Asian, or other. And it seems to be that trend going on. But when you look at the person, that is a non-white person. But for some reason, maybe I guess for statistics or numbers or the census, they are utilizing non-white, non-black people in many cases as white, and they can be as dark or as light. But when white people interact with them physically, they are going to treat them as they would treat a non-white person. And that's, I think, deliberate confusion from white supremacists. My next one is on the Kansas City Chiefs NFL player who's being, I guess, accused of being a child abuser. And it definitely looks like it's following that another example of black epitomizing. You try to promote the example of a black male specifically being dangerous and just violent and mistreats children and females. And I think it's also, they're trying to use that with the Anita Hill, I think, hearings. That was back in maybe 1991. And it's like they're trying to, it looks like they're trying to go on that example that most black people, I guess, historically have voted Democratic. And I think the black female victim, Stacey Abrams, was mentioned, I think, along with Joe Biden a couple of weeks ago. So it's some kind of confusion. I'm thinking that they're trying to orchestrate with that, too. And I wanted to ask one thing about, I think, did you hear Mr. Fuller, Gus, did you hear Mr. Fuller mention something about that Florida and I think New York is one of the main places white supremacists like to run experiments? Do you remember a comment like that?
I know I've heard him talk a lot about white supremacists running experiments. I do not recall him. I do not recall him specifically talking about Florida being one hot place where they run experiments. Do you recall like what he was saying about Florida?
Because I know I've listened to a lot of the, I don't know if it was the archives or it was maybe another program that Mr. Fuller was on. And I was thinking about that in my mind, that comment was made. I'm not entirely sure where it was made, but I do remember something about an experiment. And I was just thinking about that with the officer visibly looking non-white and how they like to classify people as white supremacists.
The racial experiment, I wasn't thinking about racial classification confusion and that being a form of experimentation to see how people respond to that. I had to think about that because it seems like maybe with the whole George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, it seems like maybe
I didn't think about that. I wouldn't, because I was thinking about something else when you were talking about experimentation. So yes, given that I'll have to think some more. Was that it, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, that'll be it. Thank you very much.
Right on. Much obliged. Let's see, the person that called in on the Skype line, then we can get back to Red in Nevada. If you're on the Skype line, do you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Black male engineer. Just some observations I've seen on the job. You know, I work in the aircraft industry, and essentially we are seeing on the job, I'm seeing a large transfer of power from older whites, 50s, 60s, to the younger whites, late 20s, early 30s, late 30s, 40s whites. And I think this is going, we'll probably see this across all the industries. I hear about retirement parties literally every day for whites. A lot of old whites are retiring, and they're looking down to hand, you know, the power back to the younger whites to keep it going. So even with that, with all these whites retiring, they understand that there aren't enough whites to replace the old whites. So so-called people of color, so-called black people, this is probably a good chance to get in certain industries, anything involving aircraft, science, technology, plumbing, a lot of the trades that are being held, that were held by older men, they're about to be moved out. This is your chance to get in, but be careful, because the younger crowd of white supremacists, I work with a number of younger white supremacists, and it's blatantly obvious to me, but the way they operate is different. So if you're not aware of that, you know, these white supremacists, they are the Richard Spencer generation. They are the Jared Taylor generation. it's like a cultural nationalist, white nationalist, European nationalist phenomena. Just be very careful, because these work environments will get hostile. Because these younger whites, they are hungry for power, and they feel like they're being persecuted. I think the synagogue shooter, he was 19, right? The one today, he was 19. So just be aware that these younger whites are a lot more unstable, so they might take their job abuses to the next level, especially if you're a teacher. You know, I'm in the Florida area. Florida, they're really pushing, either past it or they're going to pass that teacher's gun bill. So just be aware that a lot of our professions are going to be dangerous in the coming years. And that's all.
Richard Spencer generation, that is a metaphor. And I bring that up because if one doesn't know who Richard Spencer is, then that comparison is, you know, lost. I suspect maybe foul. Hopefully this won't be the case, but if 5 years from now the system of white supremacy racism still exists, if Richard Spencer is not as popular, then people might not know. That's another thing that can happen with metaphors. Sometimes they don't age as well. If you number one, workplace racism, Fridays, neutralizing workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific each Friday. If you were explaining the difference without a metaphor, in terms of the difference between these younger whites and the mentality that they bring, you would say?
I'm sorry, can you pose the question again?
If you were explaining the mentality of the younger whites who you described as being hungry and having a different mentality of white supremacy racism, if you could give, I guess, just a little bit of detail in what you mean by that.
Right. So with these younger whites, they're more inclined to actually speak to you and include you in certain events in terms of rapport and general work environment. But they do a better job of keeping key information away from you. They do a better job of making sure you're not on the right projects, right? They do a better job of making sure that you're isolated from the things that will allow you to move up on the job. Now, this is just my experience. I think some older callers could have a different experience. But my experience with older whites is that they're more inclined to give help on the job. That's just my experience personally. Younger whites, they are not inclined to give help on the job at all. But the thing is, the older whites and the younger whites, they have a better rapport with each other. So the older whites are teaching them longer and harder, but the younger whites will not, disseminate that information to black people. In my experience, it's the older whites that are actually giving the useful information. So I think that's where I see it.
The Mueller report, they were talking about the redactions. Racists, white supremacists, they are the best at concealing information. Talking about that even in James Loewen's book, Concealing Information. That is a core aspect of white supremacy racism. Workplace race and neutralizing workplace racism. Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for sharing, sir. Red in Nevada. Thank you for your patience, ma'am. Did you have commentary?
Yes, my commentary is also about workplace racism. Recently, different teams or different groups got the opportunity to speak to one of the upper managers who is a white man, and in from the meeting that I was in, it made it seem like, at least with him, that we could ask questions and we can kind of propose problems that we're having at this plantation. So no one was loud or, cursed or anything like that. I feel like everyone, for the most part, which were non-white people who spoke, save for two white women, and one of the white women said that this is one of the most unprofessional work environments she's ever been in, but everyone was pretty positive. I also spoke with another non-white person who also got the opportunity to meet with this upper manager. And again, they posed good questions. And the upper manager goes back to the supervisor, my supervisor, and says that our meeting was brutal. And then also the other non-white person who had made a comment or who had told me about the meeting that they had with the upper manager, they also said that they had also had gotten word, I don't know if from their supervisor or not, that they were also described as being brutal. And I asked the non-white person, I'm like, so who was primarily asking questions? And she said, and it was a female, and she said, she started naming the people, and I'm like, oh, so it was all non-white people. And she said, yes. So I just thought that was an interesting trend to have non-white people who are just asking questions as if that was the whole purpose of the meeting to still be described as being brutal. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Brutal. I would write that down. What does that mean exactly? Brutal. Are any others described as brutal for asking questions? Is there such a thing as a brutal question? These aren't questions that have to be asked. These could even just go in the workplace journal, things that you could think about, or you could ask it one day. It might be, hey, yes, I will ask. Is there such a thing as a brutal question? What is a brutal question? Other folks that we, Draftomania, did you have commentary? You should be with us.
Yes, thank you, Gus. And I'd like to say hello to the callers also. I just wanted to basically comment on the, I think he's the gentleman that works with the aircraft. I agree with him when it comes down to the younger suspect white supremacists. They tend to be more covert, and they some of them will mingle with us and, have supposedly white friends and interact, but they're more, I hope this is not a metaphor, more crafty. I noticed at my workplace that I noticed that the HBCUs have been allowing more suspects to come into these colleges now. So they're not, I don't know if you would still consider them as HBCUs, and they're entering into the fraternities and anything that were that was more so black. And so now they're all involved in these different groups, and they tend to interact. And it seems like the us non-white black people, from what I see, seem to be more confused, because they don't see how them, by them interacting and joining the groups and joining the ranks, that these people could still be practicing racism. So I've been thinking, just because I have been more aware of white supremacy racism, that I'm not sure if some of these people or some of these suspects are joining these colleges and things just to infiltrate, just to find out about a culture, just to maybe refine their behaviors in the future. And I also wanted to give Irie applause for taking you know, handling the situation with her son. And I am glad that she has been making progress with that. And I hope, Irie, that you are, you know, you'll be able to make more progress, and that your son is no longer being harassed by this woman. And to Thomas, I would like to thank him for always bringing up the new technology, the things that these white supremacists are using in regards to the technology to further terrorize us. It's very important that we pay attention to technology and the things that they're doing. You know, a lot of the things seems as if they're just with science fiction, but if you pay attention to the technology, you'll know that this stuff is actually going happening. And I also wanted to pose a question to Thomas, because I haven't heard from him in workplace racism in a while. I wanted to know how he's doing with his terrorists on his job. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Let's see. Thomas in New York, are you with us, sir, and able to respond to give us a workplace racism update?
Oh, absolutely. Funny you would ask. I was fired from my job, and I kind of put myself in a position where I saw that some things was changing towards the attitude toward me. So I aggressively started looking for something else. And within a week of me losing that job, I found a much better job for a much bigger company, and pays more, and don't have any terrorism going on. So, I'm generally working at the time of workplace racism, so I haven't been able to give an update. So that's my update. I did want to say this to what the gentleman from Florida said about Nellie Fuller making the assumption that they do the most experiments on black people in New York and in Florida. I immediately went and looked up the census, and as of 2018, the top four states as far as population of black people, New York was number one with 3.4 million. Black people, almost 3.5. Texas was number two with 3.4 million. Florida was number three with 3.4 million. And, you know, Georgia was number four with 3.2 million. So just thinking how white people think,
New York and Florida both have a huge population about the same, population of black people. And they also have a diverse group of black people because you have a lot of black people who don't classify themselves as black people in both of those places. You have Dominicans who look like us, but they don't classify themselves as black, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and other groups. So those two places, I would say, especially New York, because you have a million people in North Jersey, right across the river from New York City. You have a huge population of black people to do experiments on. So I could see that definitely being the reason. The only thing that stood out to me so far, my new job is working for the people who own the New York Stock Exchange. And a lot of the pictures on the wall of different commodities, I counted as pictures of cotton. And they got one picture of coffee. I mean, it's just eight pictures of cotton. This shows the importance of cotton, I guess. And the only thing that my boss has said that stood out to me that was racist was, he said, on Fridays, you can wear jeans. So I'm just letting you know, none of that hip-hop shit. I said, okay. And, you know, she reminded me of a Donald Trump-type racist, which I appreciate that type of racist. You know what I'm saying? Like, I if it's out front like that, hey, you know, I could accept that. You know, I mute myself.
Donald Trump-like racist, that is a metaphor as well. Wow. Sorry to hear about the termination, but that is the system of white supremacy. And I do think that that is important and maybe something that should be discussed on workplace racism, because I have said it for years, as have others. You can do everything correct according to your job. You can be doing spectacular work. You can be doing everything according to your counter-racist code as well, and still get fired. That's the system of racism, white supremacy. They mistreat non-white people. You just try to do the best you can to minimize the mistreatment. All of that said, got disrupted. I think it's important in a workplace environment to be attentive. If it's seeming like, wow, it has gotten very hostile towards me in this workplace, that is something to be mindful of. Like, you don't want to minimize. If you can be updating your resume and doing all of that in advance, that can put you in a much better position as opposed to being oblivious or ignoring that or acting like that's not the case. Like, really be mindful of that, because sometimes it's not that you did anything. Sometimes it's just, hey, we're firing five Negroes this week and, you know, you're number four. Nothing that you could have done about it. This is what we do. We fire niggers every week this time of year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're number four. Others, did we miss anybody? Anyone with a hand up that we missed completely? Last 10 minutes of the broadcast. I would be mindful with the situation, Mr. Hill, with the Kansas City Chiefs. He's been accused of abusing his child. Great reference, I thought, to the man not. But I think that also could be another illustration of where whites have information and they wait before they reveal that information. That the same thing happened, I think that was 2014. The running back with the Ravens, I'm forgetting his name for the time being, but where he abused his fiance. I think they were not married at the time and all of that, fiance at the time. But they had that video for months, for like a long period of time, and then they waited before they release it. And I've said that before, that sort of thing, it's not saying that what the person did is correct or incorrect, but I am saying that I have seen where sometimes racists, they will take a bit of truthful information, something that did happen, and they'll wait and they'll use it. They'll release that information in an incorrect manner or in a manner that supports white supremacy racism. And just the fact that it seems like they may have had some of this information for a long period of time and are waiting for it to be released.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Can I be heard, Gus?
Retired firefighter.
Yes, it's ironic that you brought the black male up again, because I was just waiting for opportunity to speak further on him. Some things that may be very significant to what you just got through talking about. Some of us can recall. Then again, probably not on this line, because most people, I imagine, don't watch football games. But this past season, he had an encounter with some white people as he scored a touchdown, and they spit in his face. They spit in his face and threw their refreshments in his face as he ran through the end zone. Black male was also in the process of being the highest paid receiver in the history of the National Football League before this incident went viral. The same person you're talking about, from my understanding, from what I saw on television. And also, I don't know if anybody else noticed, if they actually saw the live clips of that particular incident. The female that he has children with does not appear to be a black female. I'm not saying that she's a white female, because I have some doubt that she isn't. I did see her. They didn't give a good picture of her, but she doesn't appear to be a black female. And I don't think that she may or may not be a white female either, but just an observation. But those are some additional facts that I've witnessed over this past week on that incident. Thank you.
That's right. Yeah, Mr. Hill, prolific receiver with the Kansas City Chiefs. Forgot about that. He's about to get lots of money. That will definitely not happen now, or seems unlikely. Ray Rice, that's the name of the player I was thinking of. Ray Rice.
Yes.
Man, all of that now, compare all of that to, you know, NFL legends like Richie Incognito, who's on my mind a lot this week for some reason. Other folks, anybody else have final comments they wanted to get in before we conclude?
Can I say something else? In regards to football, related to football, you have the NFL draft, and they've been doing a lot of showing the what they call the combine, where the black men have to get, you know, pretty much stripped down and looked at in awe, delectable Negro, and they have to perform all of these outrageous tasks, you know, lifting weights 100 times in a few minutes, and jumping, you know, to this, running to this speed that they want. And it just really reminded me of a plantation type atmosphere. Just, you know, they treat them a little bit better, you know, more luxurious stuff, you know, there. But just, it was real hard to look at with these young black men saying, you know, They would do their little background stories, and they would be, you know, talking about their whole life is dependent upon how they perform for these rich white men at this combine. It just made me feel like so icky. You know, I know that's a metaphor, but I can't even think of another word without being black. So I mute myself, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Any other folks have comments, questions, suggestions they want to share?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. I just wanted to share there was a
I think, well, I think this was an act of racism in an Orbit gum commercial. It was a white man, well, a white teenager, I think, and it looked like they tried to make a setting of is what they would call a horror film, where he and a non-white female, what appears to be an Asian female, he was saying, I don't know if we should kiss. And she pulled the pack of gum out of her, I guess, sleeve or a form of clothing, and it looked like she appeared to be a zombie. And so she smiles, and her teeth are, like, I guess some people would say pearly white, the white supremacist message in that. And her arm falls off after they start kissing. So that's definitely racist right there. I don't know. Have you ever seen that commercial?
I have not.
And the slogan was "Time to Shine."
Tackiness as usual. I think the other commercial that you mentioned, when you mentioned the KFC commercial with the Miss Butterworth, that one I have seen, which I did see as racist. That one I have not. I'll have to see if I can check that one out on YouTube, or if you all find it, you can post it on my Facebook or what have you, and I'll share. If not, I'll check, but I have not seen that one. 30 seconds, are we satisfied? I will assume we are good. We will be here minimum for the book club this coming Thursday, Sundown Towns, James Lowen, suspected racist. Friday, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, both 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And the compensatory call-in next weekend. Just check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook for updates. You can drop an email as well if you have questions, guest suggestions, any other issues, problems accessing content in the archives. With that, much obliged to all the folks who participated live. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Man, be safe. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know the weather is getting warm and people are going out to frolic, go to the beach and planning vacations and all that good stuff. Cows Yoga Retreat, Labor Day weekend, August 29th through September 1. But with all of that, you still want to be codified, which would mean sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Racists, they terrorize a lot of black people. They really take advantage of us when we are not functioning at our best after they poisoned us with their narcotics. Let's keep our brain computer functioning optimally so that we can go about solving the problem, white people. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.